Bring the look this time. You've got this. Thanks, Mayor. He straightens, puffing out his chest, smiling for my benefit. I smile back, even though his voice trembles when he says my name. Most of them don't know what to call me. Mayor, Miss Barrow, the Lightning Girl. Some even say my lady. The nickname stings, but not so much as the last. No matter what I do, no matter how much I try to be one of them, they see me as something apart, either a leader or a leper, but always an outsider, always separated. Out in the alley, Krantz begins loading the cart, not bothering to watch us blink out of existence with the grace of a silver shadow. But unlike them, Harrick can not only bend light, creating brightness and darkness, he can conjure anything he wishes. A tree, a horse, another person entirely. Now that we're on the street, he masks us as obscure reds with dirty faces and hoods. We are unremarkable even to each other. He tells me this is easier than making us disappear, and a better alternative in the crowd. People won't wonder at bumping into thin air. Farley leads, following Ellie's directions. We have to cross the market square, past the eyes of many security officers, but no one gives us pause. My hair blows in the slight wind, sending a curtain of white blonde across my eyes. I almost laugh. Blonde hair on me. The Marcher house is small, with a hastily built second floor that looks liable to collapse on top of us. But it has a lovely back garden, overgrown with tangles of vines and bare trees. In the summer, it must look wonderful. We pick through it, doing our best to keep the dead leaves from crunching. We're invisible now, Herrick mutters. When I look in his direction, I realize he's gone. I smile, though no one can see it. Someone reaches the back door before me and knocks. No answer, not even a rustle inside. They could be out for the day, working. Next to me, Farley curses under her breath. Do we wait? She breathes. I can't see her, but I see the puffs of breath clouding where her face should be. Herrick's not a machine, I say, speaking for him. We wait inside. I head for the door, bumping her shoulder, and sink to a knee before the lock. A simple one. I could pick it in my sleep, and it takes no time now. Within seconds, I'm greeted by a familiar, satisfying click. The door swings back on shrieking hinges, and I freeze, waiting for what might be inside. Like Ellie's house, the inside is dark and seemingly abandoned. Still, I give it another moment, listening hard. Nothing moves inside, and I feel no tremors of electricity. Either the marchers are out of rations, or they don't even have electricity at all. Satisfied, I beckon over my shoulder, but nothing happens. They can't see you, idiot. Head in, I whisper, and I feel Farley at my back. Once the door is safely shut again, we burst back into sight. I smile at Herrick, again grateful for his ability and strength, but the smell stops me cold. The air is stale in here, undisturbed, and slightly sour. With a hasty swipe of my hand, I brush half an inch of dust from the kitchen table.
Maybe they ran. Lots of people have.
Nix offers quickly. Something draws my focus, the tiniest whisper. Not a voice, but a spark. Barely there, so soft I almost missed it. Coming from a basket by the fireplace, covered in a dirty red rag. I drift toward it, drawn by the small beacon. I don't like this. We need to regroup at Ellie's. Herrick, pull yourself together and get ready for another illusion. Farley barks as quietly as she can. My knees scrape the hearthstones as I kneel over the basket. The smell is stronger here, and so is the spark. I should not do this. I know I won't like what I find. I know it, but I can't stop myself from pulling back the rag. The fabric is sticky, and I tug, revealing what lies beneath. After a numb second, I realize what I'm looking at. I fall backward, scrambling, gasping, almost screaming. Tears fall faster than I ever thought they could. Farley is the first to my side, her arms surrounding me, holding me steady. What is it? May I, what? She stops short, choking on the words. She sees what I see. And so do the others. Nix almost vomits, and I'm surprised Herrick doesn't faint. In the basket is a baby, no more than a few days old. Dead. And not from abandonment or neglect. The rag is dyed in its blood. The message is disgustingly clear. The marchers are dead, too. One tiny fist, clawed with the stiffness of death, holds the tiniest device. An alarm. Herrick, I hiss through my tears. Hide us. His mouth falls open, confused, and I grab his leg in desperation. Hide us! He disappears before my eyes, and not a moment too soon. Officers appear in the windows, bursting through each door, guns raised, all shouting, "You're surrounded, Lightning Girl! Submit to arrest!" They roar in succession, as if repeating themselves makes any difference. Quietly, I ease myself under the kitchen table. I only hope the others have the sense to do the same. No fewer than 12 officers crowd inside, stomping back and forth. 4 break off, heading upstairs, and 1 pair of boots halts by the baby. The officer's free hand twitches, and I know he must be staring at the tiny corpse. After a long moment, he vomits into the fireplace. "Easy, Myros," one of the others says, pulling him away. "Poor thing," he adds, moving past the baby. "Anything upstairs?"
"Nothing,"
another replies, coming back down.
"Alarm must have malfunctioned."
"You sure? The governor will skin us if we're wrong. Do you see anyone here, sir?" I almost gasp when the officer drops to a crouch right in front of me. His eyes sweep back and forth beneath the table, searching. I feel a slight pressure on my leg. One of the others. I dare not respond with a nudge of my own and hold my breath.
"No, I don't," the officer finally says, standing again. "False alarm. Back to your posts."
They leave as quickly as they burst in, but I dare not breathe until their footsteps are long gone. Then I gasp, shaking, as Herrick drops the illusion and we all blink back into sight.
"Well done,"
Farley exhales, patting Herrick on the shoulder. Like me, he can barely speak and has to be helped to his feet.
"I could have taken him,"
Nix grumbles, rolling out from beneath the stairs. He crosses to the door with short strides, one hand already on the knob.
"All the same, I don't fancy being here if they come back."
"Mare." Farley's touch on my arm is gentle, especially for her. I realize I'm standing over the baby, staring. There were no babies on Julian's list, no children below the age of 3. This was not a new blood, not according to our records, or any maven might possess. The child was murdered simply because she was here. For nothing. With determination, I remove my jacket. I will not leave her like this, with only her own blood for a blanket.
"Mare, don't. They'll know we were here.
Let them know." I pull it across her, and I fight, with everything I have, the urge to lie down beside her and never get back up again. My fingers brush her tiny, cold fist. There is something beneath it. A note. Quietly, quickly, I slip it into my pocket before anyone else can see. When we finally get back to Ada and the jet, I dare to read it. It's dated for yesterday. Yesterday. We were so close. October 22. "A crude envelope, I know, but necessary. You must know what you are doing. What you are forcing me to do to these people. Everybody is a message to you and to my brother. Surrender to me, and it will stop. Surrender, and they will live. I am a man of my word. Until we meet again, Maven." We arrive back at the notch at nightfall. I cannot eat, I cannot speak. I cannot sleep. The others discuss what happened in Templin, but no one dares ask me. My brother tries, but I walk way deeper into the burrows of our hideaway. I cower in my cramped hole of a bedroom, convincing myself I need to be alone for now. On other nights, I hate this solitary room, being separated from the others. Now I hate it even more, but I can't bring myself to join them. Instead, I wait for everyone to be asleep before I let myself wander. I take a blanket, but it does nothing for the cold, inside and out. I tell myself it's the autumn chill that sends me to his room, and not the empty feeling in my stomach, not the frozen abyss that grows with every failure, not the note in my pocket, burning a hole right through me. Fire dances on the floor, confined to a neat dip ringed by stones. Even in the strange shadows, I can tell he's awake. His eyes look alive with flame, but not angry, not even confused. With one hand, he pulls back the blankets of his sleeper and slides to make room for me. "It's cold in here," I say. I think he knows what I really mean. "Farley told me," he murmurs when I settle in. He puts an arm across my waist, gentle and warm, meaning nothing but comfort. The other presses against my back, his palm flat to my scars. "I am here," it says. I want to tell him about Maven's offer, but what good would it do? He would only refuse like I have, and have to suffer the shame of that refusal with me. It will only cause him pain, Maven's true goal. And in this, I will not let Maven win. He's already conquered me. He will not conquer Cal. Somehow, I fall asleep. I do not dream. 20. From that day on, his bedchamber becomes ours. It is a wordless agreement, giving both of us something to hold on to. We're too tired to do much more than sleep, though I'm sure Killorn suspects otherwise. He stops talking to me and ignores Cal altogether. Part of me wants to join the others in the larger sleeping rooms, where the children whisper into the night and Nanny shushes them all. It helps them bond. But I would only frighten them. So I stay with Cal, the one person who doesn't really fear me. He doesn't keep me awake on purpose, but every night I feel him stir. His nightmares are worse than mine, and I know exactly what he's dreaming of. The moment he severed his father's head from his shoulders. I pretend to sleep through it, knowing he doesn't want to be seen in such a state. But I feel his tears on my cheek. Sometimes I think they burn me, but I don't wake up with any new scars. At least, not the kind that can be seen. Even though we spend every night together, Cal and I don't talk much. There isn't much to say beyond our duties. I don't tell him about the first note or the next ones. Though Maven is far away, he still manages to sit between us. I can see him in Cal's eyes, a toad squatting in his brother's head, trying to poison him from the inside out. He's doing the same thing to me, both in the notes and in my memories. I don't know why, but I can't destroy either of them, and I tell no one of their existence. I should burn them, but I don't. I find another letter in Corvium, during another recruitment. We knew Maven was on his way to the area, visiting the last major city before the Ashlands of the Choke. We thought we could beat him there. Instead, we found the king already gone. October 31. I expected you at my coronation. It seemed like the kind of thing your Scarlet Guard would love to try to ruin, even though it was quite small. We're still supposed to be mourning father, and a grand affair would seem disrespectful, especially with Cal still out there, running around with you and your rabble. A precious few still owe allegiance to him, according to Mother. But don't worry, they are being dealt with. No silver succession crisis will come and take my brother from your leash. If you could, wish him a happy birthday for me, and assure him it will be his last. But yours is coming, isn't it? I don't doubt we'll spend it together. Until we meet again, Maven. His voice speaks every word, using the ink like knives. For a moment, my stomach churns, threatening to spill my dinner all over the dirt floor. The nausea passes long enough for me to slip out of the sleeper, out of Cal's embrace, to my box of supplies in the corner. Like at home, I keep my trinkets hidden, and two more of Maven's notes are crumpled at the bottom. Each one bears the same ending. Until we meet again. I feel something like hands around my throat, threatening to squeeze the life from me. Each word tightens the grip, as if ink alone can strangle me. For a second, I fear I might not breathe again. Not because Maven still insists on tormenting me. No, the reason is much worse. Because I miss him. I miss the boy I thought he was. The brand he gave me burns with the memory. I wonder if he can feel it too. Cal stirs in the sleeper behind me, not from a nightmare, but because it's time to wake. Hastily, I shove the notes away and leave the room before he can open his eyes. I don't want to see his pity. Not yet. That will be too much to bear. Happy birthday, Cal, I whisper to the empty tunnel hall. I've forgotten a coat, and the cold of November pricks my skin as I step out of the safe house. The clearing is dark before the dawn, so that I can barely see the eaves of the forest. Ada sits over the low coals of a campfire, perched on a log, in a shivering bundle of wool blankets and scarves. She always takes last watch, preferring to wake earlier than the rest of us. Her accelerated brain lets her read the books I bring her and keep an eye on the woods at the same time. Most mornings, she's gained a new skill by the time the rest of us are up and about. Last week alone, she learned Tirax, the language of a strange nation to the southeast, as well as basic surgery. But today, she holds no stolen book, and she is not alone. Ketha stands over the fire, arms crossed. Her lips move quickly, but I can't hear what she's saying. And Killorn huddles close to Ada, his feet almost entirely in the coals. As I creep closer, I can see his brow bent in intense focus. Stick in hand, he traces lines in the dirt. Letters. Crude, hastily drawn, forming rudimentary words like boat, gun, and home. The last word is longer than the rest. Killorn. The sight almost brings new tears to my eyes, but they are happy tears, an unfamiliar thing to me. The empty hole inside me seems to shrink, if only a little. Tricky, but you're getting it, Ketha says, the corner of her mouth lifting in a half smile. A teacher indeed. Killorn notices me before I can get much closer, snapping his writing twig with a resounding crack. Without so much as a nod, he gets up from the log and swings his hunting pack over his shoulder. His knife glints at his hip, cold and sharp as the icicles fanging the trees in the woods. Killorn? Ketha asks. Then her eyes fall on me, and my presence answers her question. Oh. It's time to hunt anyways, Ada replies, reaching a hand toward Killorn's fading form. Despite the warm color of her skin, the tips of her fingers have flushed blue with the cold. But he evades her grasp, and she touches nothing but frosty air. I don't do anything to stop him. Instead, I lean back on my heels, giving him the space he so desperately desires. He draws up the hood of his new coat, obscuring his face as he stalks toward the tree line. Good brown leather and fleece lining, perfect for keeping him warm and hidden. I stole it a week ago in Haven. I didn't think Killorn would accept such a gift from me, but even he knows the value of warmth. My company this afternoon doesn't bother just him. Ketha glances at me sidelong, almost blushing. He asked to learn, she says, almost apologetic. Then she pushes past me, heading back to the warmth and relative comfort of the notch. Ada watches her go, her golden eyes bright but sad. She pats the log next to her, gesturing for me to sit. When I do, she tosses one of her blankets across my lap and tucks it around me. There you are, miss.
She was a maid in Harbor Bay, and despite her newfound freedom, old habits haven't worn off yet. She still calls me miss, though I've asked her to stop many times.
I think they need some kind of distraction.
It's a good one. No other teacher's ever made it this far with Killorn. I'll make sure to thank her later. If she doesn't run away again. We all need a little distraction, Ada. She sighs in agreement. Her lips, full and dark, purse into a bitter, knowing smile. I don't miss her eyes flicker back to the notch, where half my heart sleeps, and then to the forest, where the rest wanders.
He has Krantz with him, and Farah will join them both soon enough. No bears, either, she adds, squinting at the dark horizon.
In daylight, if the mist holds off, we should be able to see the distant mountains.
They've gone quiet for the season by now, sleeping through the winter.
Bears. At home in the Stilts, we barely had deer, let alone the fabled monsters of the backcountry. The lumber yards, logging teams, and river traffic were enough to drive away any animal bigger than a raccoon, but the Great Woods region teems with wildlife. Great antlered stags, curious foxes, and the occasional howl of a wolf all haunt the hills and valleys. I've yet to see one of the lumbering bears, but Killorn and the other hunters spotted one weeks ago. Only Farah's muffling abilities and Killorn's good sense to keep downwind kept them safe from its jaws.
Where did you learn so much about bears?
I ask, if only to fill the air with idle conversation. Ada knows exactly what I'm doing, but humors me anyways.
Governor Rombos likes to hunt, she replies with a shrug. He had an estate outside the city, and his sons filled it with strange beasts for him to kill, bears especially. Beautiful creatures, with black fur and keen eyes. They were peaceful enough if left alone, or attended to by her game warden. Little Roar, the governor's daughter, wanted a cub for her own, but the bears were killed before any could breed.
I remember Roar Rombos, a strong arm who looked like a mouse, but could pulverize stone with her own two hands. She competed in Queen's Trials so long ago, when I was a maid just like Ada.
I don't suppose what the governor did could actually be called hunting, Ada continues. Sadness poisons her voice. He put them in a pit, where he could fight the animals and break their necks.
His sons did it too, for their training. Bears sound like ferocious, fearsome beasts, but Ada's manner tells me otherwise. Her glazed eyes can only mean she's seen the pit herself, and remembers every second of it.
That's awful. You killed one of his sons, you know. Riker was his name. He was one of your chosen executioners.
I never wanted to know his name. I never asked about the ones I killed in the Bowl of Bones, and no one ever told me. Riker Rombos, electrocuted on the sand of the arena, reduced to nothing more than his blackened flesh.
Beg pardon, miss. I did not mean to upset you.
Her calm mask has returned, and with it the perfect manners of a woman raised as a servant. With her ability, I can only imagine how terrible it must have been, seeing but not speaking, never able to prove her worth or reveal her true self. But it's even worse to think that, unlike me, she can't hide behind the shield of an imperfect mind. She knows and feels so much that it threatens to pull her down. Like me, she must keep running. I'm only upset when you call me that. Miss, I mean.
A habit, I'm afraid.
She shifts, reaching for something inside her blankets. I hear the distinct sound of crinkling paper and expect to see another news bulletin detailing Maven's coronation tour. Instead, Ada reveals a very official-looking document, albeit a crumpled one with singed edges. It bears the red sword of the Norton Army.
Shade took this off that officer in Corvium.
The one I fried. I trace the burned paper, feeling the rough black material threatening to disintegrate. Strange, this survived where its holder could not. Preparations, I mutter, deciphering the order. For relief legions. She nods,
10 legions to replace the 9 holding the choke trenches. Storm Legion, Hammer Legion, Sword Legion, Shield Legion. Their names and numbers are listed plainly. 5,000 red soldiers in each, with another 500 silver officers. They're converging on Corvium before traveling together into the choke to relieve the soldiers on the lines. A terrible thing, but not something that interests me. Good that we've already checked Corvium, is all I can think to say. At least we avoided a few thousand silver officers passing through. But Ada puts a gentle hand on my arm, her long, able fingers cold, even through my sleeve. 10 to replace 9? Why? A push? Again, I don't understand why this is my problem. Maven might want to make a show of it, demonstrate what a warrior he is to make everyone forget Cal. Not likely. Trench assaults warrant at least 15 legions. 5 to guard, 10 to march. Her eyes flicker back and forth, as if she can see a battle in her mind's eye. I can't help but raise my eyebrows. As far as I know, we don't have any tactics guides lying around. The prince is well-versed in warfare, she explains. He's a good teacher. Have you shown Cal this? Her hesitation is the only answer I need. I believe it's a kill order, she murmurs, lowering her eyes. 9 legions to take up their posts, and the 10th to die. But this is crazy, even for Maven. That doesn't make any sense. Why would anyone waste 5,000 good soldiers? Their official name is the Dagger Legion. She points to the corresponding word on the paper. Like the others, it contains 5,000 reds and is heading straight for the trenches. But Governor Rombos called them something else. The Little Legion. The Little? My brain catches up. Suddenly, I'm back on the island of Tuck, in the medical ward, with the colonel breathing down my neck. He was planning to trade Cal, to use him to save the 5,000 children now marching into an early grave. The new conscripts. The kids, 15 to 17 years old. The Dagger is the first of the child legions the king has deemed combat-ready. She doesn't bother to hide her scoff. Barely 2 months of training, if that. I remember what I was like at 15. Even though I was still a thief, I was small and silly, more concerned with bothering my sister than with my future. I thought I still had a chance of escaping conscription. Rifles and ash-blown trenches had not yet begun to haunt my dreams. They'll be slaughtered. Ada settles back into her blankets, her face grim. I believe that's the idea. I know what she wants. What many would want if they knew about Maven's orders for the child army. The kids about to be sent into the choke are a consequence of the measures, a way to punish the kingdom for the Scarlet Guard's insurrection. It feels as if I've sentenced them to death myself, and I don't doubt many would agree. Soon there will be an ocean of blood on my hands, and I have no way of stopping it. Innocent blood, like the babies in Templin. We can't do anything for them. I drop my gaze, not wanting to see the disappointment in Ada's eyes. We can't fight whole legions. Mayor, can you think of a way to help them? I cut her off, my voice harsh with anger. It cows her into defeated silence. Then how could I? Of course. You're right. Miss. The proper title stings, as she meant it to. I leave you to your watch. I mumble, standing up from the log, march order still in hand. Slowly I fold it up and tuck it away, deep into a pocket. Everybody is a message to you. Surrender to me, and it will stop. We fly for Petaris in a few hours. Ada already knows our recruitment plans for the day, but telling her again gives me something to do. Cal's piloting, so give Shade a list of whatever supplies we might need. Be mindful, she replies. The king is in Delphi again, only an hour's flight away. The thought prickles my scars. 1 hour separating me from Maven's torturous manipulations, from his terror machine that turned my own power against me. Delphi? Again? Cal walks to us from the mouth of the Notch House. His hair mussed by sleep, but his eyes have never looked so awake. Why again?
I saw a bulletin in Corvium that stated he was visiting with Governor Lairland, Ada says, confused by Cal's sudden focus.
To share his condolences in person.
For Bellicose and his sons.
I met Bellicose only once, minutes before his death, but he was kind. He did not deserve the ending I helped give him. Neither did his kin.
But Cal narrows his eyes against the rising sun. He sees something we don't, something even Ada's lists and facts cannot understand.
Maven wouldn't waste time on such a thing, even to keep up appearances. The Lairlands are nothing to him, and he's already killed the New Bloods of Delphi. He wouldn't go back without a good reason.
And that is? I ask. His mouth opens, as if he expects the right answer to fall out. Nothing happens, and finally he shakes his head.
I'm not sure.
Because this is not a military maneuver. This is something else, something Cal doesn't understand. He has a talent for war, not intrigue. That is Maven and his mother's domain, and we're hopelessly outgunned on their playing field. The best we can do is challenge them on our own terms, with might, not minds. But we need more might, and fast.
Petaris, I say aloud, sounding final. And tell Nanny she's coming.
The old woman has been requesting to help since she came here, and Cal thinks she's ready to do it. Herrick, on the other hand, has not joined us on another recruitment. Not since Templin. I don't blame him. I don't need Cal to point out where the Rift region starts. As we pass from the King State, entering into the Prince State, the divide is shockingly clear from our high altitude. The airjet soars over a series of rift valleys, each one bordered by a marching line of mountains. They look almost man-made, forming long gashes like the scrape of fingernails across Earth. But these are too big, even for Silvers. This land was made by something more powerful and destructive, thousands of years ago. Autumn bleeds over the land, painting the forest below in varying shades of fire. We're much farther south than the Notch, but I see pockets of snow on the peaks, hiding from the rising sun. Like Great Woods, the Rift is another wilderness. Though its wealth lies in steel and iron, not lumber. Its capital, Petaris, is the only city in the region and an industrial nerve center. It sits on a river fork, connecting the steel refineries to the warfront, as well as the southern coal towns to the rest of the kingdom. Though the Rift is officially governed by the Windweavers of House Laris, it is the ancestral home of House Samos. As the owners of the iron mines and steel factories, they truly control Petaris and the Rift. If we're lucky, Evangeline might be skulking around, and I'll get to repay her for all her evils. The nearest rift valley to Petaris is more than 15 miles away, but offers good cover to land. This is the bumpiest of all the ruined runways, and I wonder if we've overstepped. But Cal keeps the black run in hand, getting us down safely, if shaken. Nanny claps her hands, delighted by the flight, her wrinkled face lit by a wide smile.
"Is it always this much fun?"
she asks, peering at us. Across from her, Shade pulls a grimace. He still hasn't gotten used to flying, and does his best not to lose his breakfast in her lap.
"We're looking for four New Bloods."
My voice echoes down the craft, silencing the snapping of buckles and restraints. Shade's feeling better, so he's here again, sitting next to Farley. Then there's Nanny, and the New Blood Gareth Bommet. This will be his third recruitment in 4 days, since Cal decided the former Horsemaster would be a welcome addition to our daily missions. Once he worked for Lady Ara Iral herself, maintaining her vast stable of horses at the family estate on the Capitol River. At court, everyone called her the Panther for her gleaming black hair and cat-like agility. Gareth is less complimentary. He's more likely to call her the Silk Bitch. Luckily, his work for House Iral kept him fit and limber, and his abilities are nothing to scoff at either. When I first questioned him, asking if he could do anything special, I ended up on the ceiling. Gareth manipulated the forces of gravity,
holding me to the earth. If we had been standing in the open, I probably would have ended up in the clouds. But I leave that to Gareth. Besides jettisoning people into the air, he can use his ability to fly. Gareth will drop Nanny into the city, and she'll enter the security center disguised as Lord General Loras. I glance to her, only to find myself staring at a slight older man rather than the woman I've come to know. He nods back at me and flexes his fingers, as if he's never used them before. But I know better. It's Nanny beneath that skin, pretending to be the silver commander of the air fleet. She'll get us a printout of the four new bloods living in Petaris and the rest in the Rift region. We'll follow on foot, and Shade will pull us all out. As usual, Farley is the first out of her seat. Good luck with that one, Nan, she says, jabbing a finger at Gareth. If you like this, you're going to love what he does. I don't like that smile, little miss, Nanny says in Loras's voice. Though I've seen her transform before, I'm still not used to the strange sight. Gareth laughs next to Nanny, helping her from her seat. Farley flew with me last, made a real mess of my boots when we touched down. I did no such thing, Farley replies, but she stalks down the length of the jet quickly, probably to hide her flushing face. Shade follows her as he always does, trying to smother his laughter with his hand. She's been ill lately, and has done her best to hide it, to everyone's amusement. Cal and I are the last left on the plane, though I have no cause to wait for him. He goes through the usual motions, twisting knobs and flipping switches that turn off different parts of the jet in rapid succession. I feel each one sink into electrical death, until the low hum of full batteries is all that remains. The silence pounds in time with my beating heart, and suddenly I can't get off the jet fast enough. Something frightens me about being alone with Cal, at least in daylight. But when night falls, there's no one I'd rather see.
You should talk to Killorn.
His voice stops me mid-step, frozen halfway down the back ramp. I don't want to talk to him. Heat rises with every moment as he gets closer and closer to me. Funny. You're usually such a good liar. I spin to find myself staring at his chest. The flight suit, pristine when he put it on more than a month ago, now shows distinct signs of wear. Even though he does his best to steer clear of our battles, battle has touched him still. I know Killorn better than you, and nothing I say will snap him out of his little tantrum.
Do you know he asks to come with us?
His eyes are dark, heavy-lidded. He looks like he does in the moments before he falls asleep. He asks me every night. My time at the Notch has made me blunt and easy to read. I don't doubt Cal sees the confusion I feel, or the low currents of jealousy. He speaks to you? He won't talk to me because of you. So why on earth would he... Suddenly his fingers are under my chin, tilting my head, so I can't look away.
It's not me he's mad at. He's not angry because we...
And then it's his turn to trail off. He respects you enough to make your own choices. He told me as much. But you don't believe him. My silence is answer enough.
I know why you think you can't trust anyone. By my colors, I know. But you can't go through this alone. And don't say you have me, because we both know you don't believe that either.
The pain in his voice nearly flattens me. His fingers shake, shivering against me. Slowly I pull my face out of his grasp. I wasn't going to. A half lie. I feel no claim over Cal, and won't let myself trust him. But I can't distance myself from him either. Every time I try, I find myself wandering back. He isn't a child, Mare. You don't have to protect him anymore. To think, all this time, Killorn has been angry because I want to keep him alive. I almost laugh at the idea. How dare I do such a thing? How dare I want to keep him safe? Then bring him along next time. Let him stumble into a grave. I know he hears the tremor in my voice, but politely pretends to ignore it. And since when do you care about him? I barely hear his answer as I walk away. I'm not saying this for his sake. Down on the runway, the others are waiting. Farley busies herself strapping Nanny to Garrett's chest, using a jerry-rigged harness from one of the jet seats, but Shade is staring at his feet. He heard every word, judging by the stern set of his features. He glares at me as we pass, but says nothing. I'll be in for another scolding later, but for now our focus turns toward Pitaris and hopefully another successful recruitment.
Arms in, head down,
Gareth says, instructing Nanny. Before our eyes, she morphs from the bulky Lord General into her much smaller, thinner self. She tightens the straps accordingly.
Lighter this way, she explains with a tiny giggle.
After long days of serious talk and restless nights, the sight makes me laugh outright. I can't help it, and have to cover my mouth with my hand. Gareth awkwardly pats the top of her head.
You never cease to amaze, Nan. Feel free to shut your eyes.
She shakes her head.
Had shut eyes my whole life, she says. Never again.
When I was a child, dreaming of flying like a bird, I never imagined anything like this. Gareth's legs don't bend. His muscles don't tense. He doesn't push off the ground. Instead, his palms flatten, parallel to the runway, and he simply starts to lift. I know the gravity around him is loosening, a thread being untied. He rises with Nanny strapped close, faster and faster, until he's merely a speck in the sky. And then the thread tightens, pulling the little dot along the earth, up and down in smooth, rolling arcs, loose, then tight, until they disappear over the nearest ridge. From down here, it almost looks peaceful, but I doubt I'll ever find out firsthand. The jet is flight enough for me. Farley is the first to look away from the horizon and return to the task at hand. She gestures to the rising hill above us, crested with red and gold trees.
Shall we?
I march ahead in reply, setting a good pace to get us up and over the ridge. According to our now vast collection of maps, the mining village of Rosen should be on the other side, or at least what once was Rosen. A coal fire destroyed the place years ago, forcing reds and silvers alike to abandon the valuable, if volatile, mines. According to Ada's readings, it was abandoned overnight, and most likely has a wealth of supplies for us. For now, I intend to pass through, if only to see what we can raid on the way back. The ashen smell hits me first. It clings to the west side of the slope, strengthening with every step we take down the ridge. Farley, Shade, and I are quick to cover our noses with our scarves, but Cal isn't bothered by the heavy perfume of smoke. Well, he wouldn't be. Instead, he sniffs at it, tentative.
Still burning,
he whispers, eyeing the trees. Unlike the other side of the ridge, the oaks and elms here look dead. Their leaves are few, their trunks gray, and not even weeds grow between their gnarled roots. Somewhere deep. If Cal wasn't with us, I would be afraid of the lingering coal fire, but even the red heat of the mines is no match for him. The prince could wave off an explosion if he wanted, and so we continue on, pleasantly silent in the dying wood. Mine shafts dot the hillside, each one hastily boarded up. One breathes smoke, a dull trail of gray clouds lifting into the hazy sky. Farley fights the urge to investigate, but is quick to climb low branches or rocks. She scouts the area with quiet intensity, always on guard, and always within a few feet of Shade, who never takes his eyes off her. I'm quietly reminded of Julian and Sarah, two dancers moving to music no one else can hear. Rosen is the grayest place I've ever seen. Ash coats the entire village like snow, floating on the air in flurries, hugging the buildings in waist-high drifts. It even blots out the sun, surrounding the village in a permanent cloud of haze. I'm reminded of the techie slums of Greytown, but that foul place still pulsed like a sluggish blackened heart. This village is long dead, killed by an accident, a spark deep in the mines. Only the main street, a shoddy cross of a few brick storefronts and plank homes, is still standing. The rest has collapsed or burned. I wonder if there's bone dust swirling in the ash we breathe. No electricity. I can't feel anything, not even a light bulb. A cord of tension releases in my chest. Rosen is long gone, and offers us no harm. Check the windows. They follow my example, wiping the glass storefronts with already dirty sleeves. I squint into the smallest of the still-standing buildings, barely a closet squashed between a smashed security outpost and the half-collapsed schoolhouse. When my eyes adjust to the dim light, I realize I'm looking at rows and rows of books, cluttered onto shelves thrown into haphazard piles, spilled across the grimy floor. I grin against the glass, dreaming of how many treasures I can bring back for Ada. A smash splinters through my nerves. I whirl to the sound, only to see Farley standing by a storefront window. She holds a piece of wood, and there's glass at her feet. "They were trapped," she explains, gesturing into the shop. After a moment, a flock of crows explodes from the broken window. They disappear into the ashen sky, but their cries echo long after they're gone. They sound like children in pain. "My colors," Cal swears under his breath, shaking his head in her direction. She only shrugs, smirking. "Did I scare you, Your Highness?" He opens his mouth to answer, the corners of his mouth pulled in a smile, but someone cuts him off. A voice I don't recognize, coming from a person I've never seen. "Not yet, Diana Farley." The man seems to materialize out of the ash. His skin, hair, and clothes are just as gray as the dead village, but his eyes are a luminous, horrifying blood red. "Though you will. You all will." Cal calls on his fire, I on my lightning, and Farley raises her gun in the direction of the gray man. None of these things seem to frighten him. Instead, he takes a step forward, and his crimson gaze finds me. "Mayor Barrow," he sighs, as if my name brings him great pain. His eyes water. "I feel like I already know you." None of us move, transfixed by the sight of him. I tell myself it's his eyes, or his long gray hair. His appearance is peculiar even to us, but that's not what keeps me rooted to the spot. Something else has put me on edge, an instinct I don't understand. Though this man looks bent with age, unable to throw a punch, let alone brawl with Cal, I can't help but fear him. "Who are you?" My quavering voice echoes over the empty village. The gray man tips his head, staring at each of us in turn. With every passing second, his face falls until I think he might start crying. "The new bloods of Petaris are dead. The king waits for you there." Before Cal can open his mouth to ask what we're all thinking, the gray man holds up a hand. "I know because I have seen it, Tiberius, just like I saw you coming." "What do you mean, saw?" Farley growls, taking quick steps toward him. Her gun is still tight in her hand, ready to be used. "Tell us." "Such a temper, Diana," he chides, sidestepping her with surprisingly quick feet. She blinks, perplexed, and lunges, trying to grab him. Again, he dodges. "Farley, stop!" I surprise even myself with the order. She sneers at me but obeys, circling around so that she's behind the strange man. "What's your name, sir?" His smile is just as gray as his hair. "That is of no consequence. My name isn't on your list. I come from beyond your kingdom's borders." Before I get a chance to ask him how he knows about Julian's list, Farley charges with all her speed, sprinting at the man's back. Though she makes no sound, though he can't see her, he easily steps out of her path. She falls into the ash face first, cursing, but wastes no time getting to her feet. Now she has her gun aimed at his heart. "You going to dodge this?" she snarls, letting a bullet click into place. "I won't have to," he replies with a wry smile. "Will I, Miss Barrow?" "Of course." "Farley, leave him be. He's another new blood. You're an eye," Cal breathes, taking a few shuffling steps toward the ashen street. "You can see the future." The man scoffs, waving a hand. "An eye sees only what they look for," Their sight is narrower than a blade of grass. Again, he fixes us with his sad, scarlet stare. But I see everything. 21. Only when we enter the burned-out husk of the Rosen Tavern does the gray man speak again, introducing himself as we take seats around a charred table. His name is shockingly simple. John. And his presence is the most unsettling thing I've ever felt. Every time he looks at me, with eyes the color of blood, I get the sense that he can see right through my skin, to the twisted thing I used to call a heart. But I keep my thoughts to myself, if only to allow Farley more room to air her grievances. She alternates between grumbling and shouting, arguing that we can't trust this strange man who appeared out of the ash. Once or twice, Shade has to calm her down, putting his hands on her arms to still her. John sits through it all with a tight smile, staring down her oppositions, only speaking when she finally shuts her mouth. "The four of you are well known to me, so there's no need for introductions," he says, holding up a hand in Shade's direction. My brother makes a strangled kind of noise, drawing back a little. "I found you because I knew where you would be. It was nothing to coordinate my journey with yours," John adds, turning his gaze on Cal. His face whitens in a flush, but John doesn't bother to watch. Instead, he looks to me and his smile softens a bit. "He'll be a good addition, albeit a creepy one." "I have no intention of joining you at the Notch, Miss Barrow." Then it's my turn to swallow my tongue. Before I can recover enough to ask, he answers for me again, and it feels like a cold stab to the belly. "No, I cannot read your thoughts, but I do see what is to come. For instance, what you say next, I figure I'd save us some time." "Efficient," Farley grinds out. She's the only one of us not transfixed by this man. "Why don't you just tell us what you came to say and be done with it? Better yet, just tell us what's going to happen." "Your instincts serve you well, Diana," he replies, bowing his gray head. "Your friends, the Shifter and the Flyer, will return soon. They met resistance at the Petara Security Center and will need medical attention. Nothing Diana cannot accomplish on your jet." Shade moves to stand from his chair, but John waves him back down. "Easy. You have some time yet. The King has no intention to pursue." "Why not?" Farley raises an eyebrow. The crimson eyes meet mine, waiting for me to answer. "Gareth can fly, something no known silver can do. Maven won't want anyone to see that, even his sworn soldiers." Cal nods next to me, knowing his brother as much, or as little, as I do. "He told the Kingdom New Bloods didn't exist, and he intends to keep it that way." "One of his many mistakes," John muses, his voice dreamy and far away. "He probably is, looking into a future none of us can comprehend. But you'll find that out soon enough." I expect Farley to be the one to snarl at more riddles, but Shade beats her to it. He leans forward on his hands so that he towers over John. "Did you come here to show off, or just to waste our time?" I can't help but wonder the same thing. The gray man doesn't flinch, even in the face of my brother's restrained anger. "Indeed I did, Shade. A few more miles and Maven's eyes would see you coming. Or would you have liked to walk into his trap? I confess, I can see action, but not thought. And perhaps you wanted to be imprisoned and executed?" He looks around at us, his tone shockingly cheerful. One side of his mouth lifts, curving his lips into a half-smile. "Petaris would have ended in death, and even worse fates." Worse fates. Under the table, Cal's hand closes over my own, as if he feels the tremble of dread coiling in my stomach. Without thought, I open my palm to him, letting his fingers find mine. What worse fates were planned for us, I don't even want to ask. "Thank you, John." My voice is thick with fear. "For saving us." You saved nothing, Cal says quickly, and his grip tightens. Any decision could have changed what you saw. A misstep in the woods, the beating of a bird's wings. I know how people like you see, and how wrong your predictions can become.
John's smile deepens until it splits his face. That rankles Cal more than anything else, even more than his birth name.
I see farther and clearer than any of the silver eyes you've ever met. But it will be your choice to hear what I must say. Although you do come to believe me, he adds, almost winking. Sometime around your discovery of the jail.
Julian Jacos is a friend, is he not?
Now both our hands are shaking.
He is, I murmur, eyes wide and hopeful.
He's still alive, isn't he?
Again John's eyes gloss over. He mutters to himself words inaudible and nods occasionally. On the table his fingers twitch, moving back and forth like a rake through tilled earth.
Pushing and pulling. But at what?
Yes, he is alive, but he is scheduled for execution, as is, he pauses, thinking, Sarah Skonos.
The next moments pass strangely, with John answering all our questions before we can get them past our lips.
Maven plans to announce their executions to set another trap for you and yours. They are being held at Koros Prison. It's not abandoned, Tiberius, but rebuilt. For silver imprisonment, silent stone in the walls, diamond glass reinforcements, and military guards. No, that's not all for Julian and Sarah. There are other dissenters within the cells, imprisoned for questioning the new king or crossing his mother. House Larilan has been particularly difficult, as well as House Eral, and the new blood prisoners are proving to be just as dangerous as the Silvers.
New bloods? Explodes from me, cutting off John as he continues, rapid fire.
The ones you never found, the ones you assumed to be dead. They were taken to observe, to examine, but Lord Jacos refused to study them, even after persuasion.
Bile rises in my mouth. Persuasion can only mean torture.
There are worse things than pain, Miss Barrow, John says softly. The new bloods are now at the mercy of Queen Ilara. She intends on using them with precision.
His eyes stray to Cal, and they share a glance filled with painful understanding.
They will be weapons against their own, controlled by the Queen and her kin, if given enough time. And that is a very, very dark road. You must not allow this to happen.
His cracked and dirty nails dig into the table, carving deep grooves into the blackened wood.
You must not.
What happens if we free Julian, then the others? I lean forward in my chair. Can you see that?
If he's lying, I can't tell.
No.
I see only the current path, and however far it leads. For example, I see you now surviving the Pitaris trap, only to die 4 days on. You wait too long to assault Koros.
Oh, wait. It's changed now that I've told you.
Another strange, sad smile.
This is nonsense, Cal growls, untangling his hand from mine.
He stands up from the table slow and deliberate as rolling thunder.
People go crazy listening to predictions like yours, ruined by knowledge of an uncertain future.
We have no proof but your word,
Farley chimes in. For once, she finds herself in agreement with Cal, and it surprises them both. She kicks back her chair, actions fast and violent.
And a few party tricks.
Party tricks. Predicting what we're going to say, reading Farley's attacks before she makes them. Those are no such thing. But it's easier to believe John is an impossibility. It's why everyone believed Maven's lies about me, about New Bloods. They saw my power with their own eyes and chose to trust what they could understand, rather than what was true. I'll make them pay for their foolishness, but I won't make their mistake. Something about John rattles me. An instinct tells me have faith, not in the man, but at least in his